Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sisano. Hello, everyone. Today, I have Martin Koppelman on the podcast. Martin is the co-founder and CEO of Gnosis. Gnosis is working on building a prediction market, Dutch auction-based exchange called DutchX, a DAO to manage that DutchX, as well as a new generation Ethereum wallet called Gnosis Safe. Thanks for joining me today, Martin.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm sure most of those listening at this point know Gnosis for the prediction market, but I know your team has been working on a lot more than just that. So can you talk about the state of your team at this point in time?
Sure, yeah. So we are, in terms of size, we are 50 people right now. And yeah, the main or the three big things we are working on are prediction markets, exchanges that should be used or that should be to trade those predictions, but the exchanges are general and you can also trade different stuff there. And finally, what you mentioned, the Gnosis Safe, a smart contract wallet.
Cool. So yeah, you guys have a lot going on there. And I know, like, obviously 2018 has been a little bit of a rough bear market. And just in general, there's been some concerns over some teams that maybe went through an ICO or whatever it might be that built out a team in 2017, 2018, and maybe have a lot of burn rate and not much runway left. How's Gnosis doing on that front? And how have you kind of offset the risk of the crypto bear market that we've went through in the last year?
Yeah, I mean, we have been lucky, to be honest. So we did our token sale in early in April 2017. At the time, we raised 12.5 million. But at the time, Ether was $50. So we raised 250,000 Ether. And frankly, we just have been lucky in the sense that we sold a good amount end of 2017, or actually January 2018. So that is not an issue for us. So we are transparent about the numbers. We have 30 million in cash. That gives us that kind of just our cash reserves give us the runway for roughly five more years at our current burn rate. And in addition, we have 220,000 Ether now again, because we actually bought a bit when Ether was at $80.
Yeah, that's smart. You got to buy when everyone's panicking, right? No, that's good to hear. I mean, you guys just keep pumping out products and it seems like you're building and building. And so it's good to hear that have some sound treasury management there going as well. And, you know, you're set up for the future. That's great to hear, because I think your team is one of the most important right now as far as building on Ethereum goes. So I guess I'll start with the prediction market, because that's originally how I personally heard of Gnosis and something I'm very interested in. I know you guys launched the alpha of the market called Olympia about a year ago. What's the current status of Gnosis prediction market?
Yeah, I mean, we even launched, not a lot of people know that, but we kind of technically we launched fully functioning prediction market 2 or 3 weeks after Frontier. So, I mean, really, really early. And we had a couple of markets there. And I mean, there have been iterations and iterations. And yes, a year ago, we had this Olympia running, or we had it also, or we had it running this year a few times on testnet. And yeah, the contracts are ready, or we also have it deployed on mainnet. And it is usable on mainnet. The problem is, or the challenge is, legal, basically. So, I mean, prediction markets are legally challenging, or there's just, they are heavily regulated, basically. So in the end, you have two choices. You can try to build something fully decentralized, and then you make the claim you are not the operator whatsoever, and you just release it and see what happens, basically. Or you have still components where you are some form of operator or some form of centralization, and then you will have to get a license. So that's exactly our approach. We are doing both. So we are, this version I'm talking about that is live and ready, that still is somewhat centralized, or it's at least not fully decentralized. So we want to get that running, but we will have to have a license for that, and that's basically holding us back. We are pretty close to get a license to be able to operate that, but that's kind of the reason why. So it's not a technical issue, it's a legal issue. On the other side, we are in parallel, of course, working on fully decentralized things, or just basically prediction market framework, which anyone can use who wants to build an application. Because when I say it's legally complicated, it's really application specific, because there are so many things you can do with prediction markets, and you really have to evaluate it kind of case by case, application by application, and actually country by country, what the requirements are to offer that.
Yeah, I'm sure the legal overhead here is vast, and it sounds like you guys are making the right approach to just make sure everything's in line and then kind of release it, and at the same time giving you some time to work on fully decentralizing it. I guess kind of on that point, we saw Augur, which I guess is a sort of competitor to Gnosis, launch in 2018. How do you think that launch went, and did your team kind of learn anything from Augur being on mainnet?
Sure. I think it went well, I guess. I mean, or first, I have to give a lot of credit to Augur, because it is, I think, in my opinion, and I think there is no, it's not questionable, it's the most complex Ethereum project that is live right now. So yeah, congratulations to that one. They actually kind of went the extra, the many extra miles to make it fully decentralized. So on the one hand, that's great. On the other hand, obviously, Augur is somewhat hard to use, somewhat expensive to use. There are a lot of details specifically around the market mechanisms, around the Oracle taking quite a while to resolve. And I think there are plans for all of that. I think the bottom line for us is that we think both sides are necessary. On the one hand, you can offer a much better user experience if you have some parts centralized. And again, then you probably will need a license, or at least legal becomes a big topic. And on the other hand, and that is specifically our focus on market mechanisms, that we want to build market mechanisms that are fully decentralized, but much more efficient and address problems that you have with decentralized market mechanisms as Augur uses them. So Augur uses kind of a very simple market mechanism, just basically implements an order book on the blockchain, which really makes it hard to provide sufficient liquidity for those markets. And I think that's the main reason why Augur has not been... Yeah, I mean, we have seen some traction on some markets, but it has not been kind of widely successful. And I think the absolute main reason is a lack of liquidity. And we would say a big part of that is that it's hard to provide sufficient liquidity for fairly inefficient market mechanisms. And again, like a full on-chain order book is fairly inefficient, because it's expensive to, I mean, you have cost to create an order, you have a cost to cancel an order. So kind of just for market making and running a market maker that it would update the prices, let's say every, 30 minutes, which is already kind of, usually you would want to update them even more often, but even updating the prices every 30 minutes is a significant gas cost. It would cost you many thousand dollars, probably a week. To just kind of update the prices.
Yeah, I love the Augur project. And like you said, it's definitely, in my opinion, I totally agree with you, the most complex mainnet dApp that's out there now, but it definitely comes with a lot of UX problems. I mean, I've used it a couple times, but even when I'm in there and trying to make trades, I'm fairly lost. And it seems like we're starting to see kind of third-party tools pop up to be built on top, which are more kind of specialized UX user experience cases, which is cool to see. In your mind, what are the ways that Gnosis differs from Augur, and how are you guys trying to tackle some of these challenges that we're talking about as far as user experience and liquidity pooling goes?
Right. So I think the core difference is Augur mainly focused on the decentralized Oracle problem, and Gnosis mainly focuses on the efficient decentralized market mechanism problem. So in that sense, I would say at this point, the two projects are fairly complementary. So basically, our stance is we need some Oracle. And that's actually something Gnosis is not doing. We're doing a lot, but we are not building oracles. And Augur would be an option. So you could use a Gnosis market with Augur as an oracle, but there are also plenty of others, plenty of other decentralized oracles, but also more and more centralized oracles. And we believe that for a wide range of applications, that's perfectly fine. So the Bloombergs of this world, the Reuters, the stuff like Wolfram, they have this big knowledge base or database. They all looked into bringing their data or kind of offering their data for smart contracts already 2-3 years ago. We are in contact with all of them. And the good thing is all they need to do is sign their data. And sign them in a predictable way. And that is enough to be an oracle for Ethereum smart contracts. So the super interesting thing is if a Gnosis market wants to use, let's say, Bloomberg as an oracle, that does not mean Bloomberg needs to interact with the Gnosis market or resolve the Gnosis market or even know about the Gnosis market. They just have to somewhere publish the result and sign it. And it can then be used to resolve this market. And we, again, believe for many applications that is perfectly fine and probably faster and more efficient than the decentralized Oracle Augur is building. But there's clearly also applications where a decentralized Oracle might be required, and then it's good to have Augur, I guess. Coming back to what we are, again, focusing on, definitely the market mechanisms to effectively trade prediction markets.
That makes sense. Yeah, and I agree with you on the Oracle front too, and that's kind of a classic problem. And for anybody that's listening, maybe isn't really sure what an Oracle is, you can think of it pretty simply. If we have some type of prediction market out there, whether it's on Augur or Gnosis or wherever it might be, let's say it's what will the price of Apple stock be above $200 at the end of 2020. Once that market settles, there needs to be some type of source of information to say if that what the actual price was, and then the market can settle and say who the winners and losers are. Augur attempts to do this through kind of a decentralized mechanism of staking rep, and we're seeing a very interesting kind of situation play out in a market there around the House and who won it in the election in 2018. Goes through a lot of rounds of kind of staking money and what the proper outcome is. That's a very complex mechanism, and that's what Augur has decided to use. There's a lot of different dApps out there. Anthony and I talked on last week's weekly recap about how Maker uses a price oracle. Right now, that is not fully decentralized either. They're kind of looking into ways of to change that price oracle, but you know, kind of whoever can figure this oracle problem out first, that's going to be a huge win for this ecosystem. And it's probably not going to be just one single solution like you mentioned. So I guess moving on from the prediction market side, kind of the latest bit of development and news from your team has been around DutchX and the DX DAO. I'd love to first dive into DutchX and then discuss the DAO and how that comes into play. So, you know, I think the core mechanism around DutchX is the idea of Dutch auctions. Can you kind of talk about that and how they differ from traditional exchanges people are used to seeing?
Yeah, I want to make, again, the distinction clear between two type of decentralized exchanges. So, but we all know there are like plenty decentralized exchanges. I think there is a list of maybe even 100 or more. But it's super important to realize that there are significant differences between decentralized exchanges. What they all usually do, or what they all are, is non-custodial. So you basically never lose control over your funds, and if you do a trade, then it's an atomic thing that you kind of send away some tokens and you receive the other tokens. So yeah, they are always non-custodial. What a big difference is whether there is some form of operator that does the matchmaking and is kind of maybe holding an order book and again, doing the matchmaking. And what we are seeing lately is that projects that are doing that. So that's, for example, IDEX, that are many 0x relayers. They are having this role of an operator who's doing the matchmaking, that they basically fall under many regulatory requirements, and that requires them to, or many of them have said that they will have to do KYC rules, that they will, and that they also will be very, need to be very, well, they basically need to actively decide which tokens to trade or which tokens they can offer. For they can't just allow anyone to list any token there because they are responsible and they, for example, usually can't offer securities and so on. So on the other hand, you can go a step further and you can build something fully decentralized where also this matchmaking is not done without any form of operator. And if you have such a system, there is really no gatekeeper or something like that. So basically, as someone who creates a new asset, a new token, you can just go ahead and yourself add that new token to such a decentralized exchange. And that's really what we are interested in. And really, we are intrigued by this concept of basically permissionless innovation. We think that there will be still so many more token types and token classes, really this long tail of tokens, and that might be many forms of prediction markets, and there's many things you can create with those. Not just when people usually think of prediction markets, they think of how will Brexit vote will go, or kind of those questions, whether some events happen, but you can do more complex things. You can do also things, how does one event affect the likelihood of another event happening? How does Brexit affect the GDP of Britain? Or you can also do, how does, long story short, there will be millions of new, or we call them conditional tokens, a new asset class. And as soon as you have such an explosion, and like similar to the ICO boom, and you suddenly have millions or at least 10,000s of new tokens, you really want a mechanism where you have this type of permissionless innovation where someone can create a new thing and just list it somewhere. So long story short, we are interested in building decentralized exchanges where also the matchmaking and the exchange part is decentralized and not just a non-custodial.
Makes sense. And I think I fully agree with what you're saying. We need permissionless, kind of totally decentralized places that we're just getting started here. There's going to be so many types of digitalized assets and, like you said, prediction tokens and whatever it might be. Can you talk a little bit about how DutchX, like the actual trading mechanism, differs from maybe traditional exchanges that people are used to seeing?
Right. So that was kind of the very long story. And then the thing is, building such a fully decentralized trading system with the current restrictions and the current constraints, and they include still like fairly high transaction costs, at least if you realize, okay, for every order you have to post and every order you have to cancel, it's an Ethereum transaction, that suddenly becomes very expensive. So we tried to design a system that can reasonably well find the price. So A is fully decentralized. Everything runs on chain. B, you don't require that many transactions to still find a price. Or as someone who wants to sell something, you get a decent spread basically. So right now, if you there is no decentralized exchange where you could put in a $50,000, $100,000 market order, they all have too little liquidity for that. So we really thought hard about how could we design an exchange that can handle a $100,000 market order. And we came up with the Dutch exchange mechanism. So how it works is, let's say I want to sell $100,000 worth of Ether for DAI. Then I put those $100,000 worth of Ether into the Dutch exchange, and it will start an auction every 6 hours. And basically, everyone who wants to sell Ether puts their Ether in during some period, and then at some point the auction starts, and it's trying to sell those Ether at a fairly high price. So it starts at double the previous price, so roughly double the market price, and then over time the price will algorithmically fall down. And after 6 hours, it will reach the previous price. So that's roughly the market price. After 24 hours, it will reach zero. So, and then during the time, we call the person who is like selling the Ether, that's kind of the seller. And during this time, bidders or buyers can, in this case, start to bid DAI. So basically, as soon as the price reaches a point where they say, that's acceptable to me, they can make a bid. And as soon as there are enough bidders that at the current price, all the bidders together would match all the sell demand, then the price or the auction closes. And every bidder and every seller, kind of you have the single price clearing. So every bidder and every seller gets that final clearing price.
That's really cool. Yeah, definitely a very interesting and at least new to me mechanism to kind of trade and settle trades. And especially, like you said, if someone's trying to trade maybe a large amount on a decentralized exchange, that's very hard to do right now, but this seems like a good way for them to do it. And you explaining that, I was thinking in my head, are there any, what if a seller puts it in and there aren't that many bidders and the price falls much lower than they were wanting? Is there any way to kind of put like a minimum sale price on it? Or is once it's in there, it's just open for bidding?
Right. So the only thing you can do is participate yourself as the bidder at some point.
That makes sense. Okay, got it. Cool. So it seems to me like this, that we've seen a lot of talk about front running in decentralized exchanges, which essentially, I mean, it's a very long story, but to make it short, miners can kind of see trades up front and they could get in front of bids or buyers and sellers in the blocks and kind of manipulate decentralized exchanges to an extent. Is the Dutch X a way to prevent this?
Yeah. So it depends a little bit on the how many bidders participate. But as soon as you have more bidders, what you can do with front running is you might not be able to front run at all, and if you can, it's much less severe than in order book exchanges.
That's good. Yeah, I mean, it's a big problem right now on DEXs, so any solutions to kind of help appease that, I'm definitely open to. And this kind of leads us into, I know very recently your team announced the DX or Dutch X DAO. I know everyone in this space kind of shudders a little bit at the word DAO, but in my opinion, it's kind of time to start bringing this back into play because it can be a powerful mechanism. Can you kind of talk about what the DX DAO is and how this interacts with the Dutch X exchange?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, we really are very excited about this experiment, and we are... I'm not afraid to compare it with the DAO, or I mean I think still the DAO failed spectacular, obviously, but it already gave an idea what might be possible with DAOs, or kind of that there is big promises or big potential, and we think it's definitely worse after 2.5 years to start another big DAO experiment. And obviously, we learned from it. Yeah, the ecosystem matured quite a bit. So things will be different, but it will also be an ambitious project. So it starts very simple. This DAO will be in control of this Dutch exchange contracts. And what does it mean? Well, that means it can change a few parameters in the exchange. So the exchange has some parameters like a threshold when an auction should start, or around fees, but the most important thing is it can actually upgrade or change in a way the contract. And we think it is a DAO is a fairly good compromise between the two extremes. The one extreme is fully immutable. You have your contract and you can never change it. The other extreme is, well, you have one team and it controls it, it can change it. And we think DAO is a good middle ground. So explaining again, why are those two poles not ideal? So on the one hand, on the immutable side, the issue is, there might be improvements. There might be things, how you can do things more efficient, faster, if a new hard fork comes, sometimes it offers options to make things more more efficient, more gas efficient. So you want to have the ability to upgrade. On the other hand, if Gnosis would just control the Dutch exchange, you could upgrade it. We would believe it less be this infrastructure component, and the Dutch exchange, we really see it as the infrastructure component. For example, all the decentralized finance stuff, they often, for example, need you mentioned Maker already, a price feed in the new version of Maker, they will need price feeds for many tokens, and the Dutch exchange actually is a good mechanism to provide such a price feed. So or it's also a good liquidation mechanism. So if you have some token and you need to liquidate them for another token, this auction mechanism is also quite a good mechanism. So we want others to build stuff around and on top of the Dutch exchange, but they shouldn't kind of be reliant on Gnosis and kind of if we decide to screw something up or whatever, do something. There we think the DAO is a good middle ground to have control over such a system.
Cool. Yeah, and what you just said is actually very interesting. Using the auction for liquidation point, that totally makes sense to me, and I could see it being used for that someday. So how do people get involved in this DAO, and kind of, how does the voting work? Are there coins that people can get to kind of represent a vote, or how does that mechanism work?
Right. So first, I should mention that the DAO can, of course, and is meant to do much more things. So it can like control this Dutch exchange, but the abilities or stuff DAOs can do has increased tremendously. So one super important thing is we are talking about decentralized exchanges are also the front ends. So you have the smart contract and that's all fine and decentralized, but still usually until now you still have someone or some, normally you have a normal website as a front end, and that's centrally hosted, and Maker just announced that they would take down the front end for Oasis Dex. Unfortunately, I liked Oasis Dex. So the nice thing is now a DAO can in a way, or we have the technology that in a way a DAO can host a front end as well. And that is through ENS and IPFS. So the DAO can control the ENS domain and point that ENS domain to an IPFS object that contains the website or the front end. And MetaMask already enables that. So MetaMask already enables to resolve, if you, for example, type in HTTP slow minus trade dot ease, MetaMask will resolve that to the appropriate or to the correct IPFS content. So that's just one piece the DAO could additionally do, and then you'd really have a decentralized exchange where no piece anymore is kind of has a single point of failure. How do people get involved? So we try to make this DAO widely with as many stakeholders as possible. Our internal goal is to have at least 1,000, ideally like more like 10,000. So there will be a period of 1 month starting February 18th where people can do different actions to acquire what is called reputation. There was some confusion about Augur using rep and this DAO also using the word reputation. It's actually coming from DAOstack. So DAOstack is one of the three together with the other two I'm aware of is Aragon and Colony. DAOstack is one of the those companies building DAO infrastructure. And for this DX DAO, we are using DAOstack. And in the DAOstack system, you have reputation holders that are the voters of the DAO. And to become a voter of this DAO, again, we will have this 1 month period where people can do different things. And that will be something like 50% of the reputation will be awarded to traders on the Dutch exchange, basically those who trade during this 1 month. And then you can also do other things like just locking down Ether, for a month. Again, you will get it back, the Ether. It's just kind of a proof of interest or proof of decentralization. You can also lock down, 30% will be given for just locking down ERC20 tokens that are traded on the Dutch exchange.
Yeah, that's cool. I like that. And I mean, just in thinking about what you were talking about with Oasis DEX, I was just having that same thought the other day. I mean, they're being forced to take down the front end, I'm assuming due to some kind of regulatory pressure or KYC, but I was thinking hopefully someone maybe anonymously takes the contract, spins it up on IPFS and uses an ENS domain. It sounds like this is something that this DAO can accomplish, which is a really cool thought.
And I think the advantage is that the DAO can one issue with a anonymous hosted front end is that it's it might be malicious and it might be then changed, and I think something like a DAO can actually build up a reputation and have in a way oversight, because if there are then really 1,000 or 10,000 people participating in this DAO, if you would then change this front end, for example, it would need to go through a proposal process. People could vote on it, and I think the DAO can be much more reliable.
Absolutely, a lot more transparent too. So that's the prediction market side and the Dutch X and the DAO side. So obviously you guys are already busy with that. Although one of my favorite projects in the space right now is another one of yours called Gnosis Safe. I kind of think it opens a whole new world of benefits to wallets versus what we're currently used to. So I want to quickly talk about that as well. How does Gnosis Safe differ from traditional wallets that most people are used to in the crypto space today?
Right. So Gnosis Safe, the core difference is that it is a smart contract wallet. So usually, almost all wallets are, they are just a private key, you might have multiple, but in the end, kind of your address is directly controlled by a private key you have. And that basically means it's a what some people call an all or nothing wallet. So you either have full control over it and then you can do anything with it, or you have no control. As soon as you have a smart contract, then your tokens or your assets, your reputation, if you use it for the Dutch X, are held by the smart contract, and you can define basically access rights to that smart contract. And the simplest form is you just have one key that has access, and then in a way you can, through this key, you have access to your assets. However, that setup enables quite a bit of, or a whole bunch of potential improvements. First one is, I mean, just stuff like, that's actually one of the first things we have enabled with the Gnosis Safe is kind of just a simple two-factor. So instead of having just one key that controls your tokens and your assets, you have two keys. And in the case of the Gnosis Safe, how that practically looks like is we have a Chrome plugin that's quite similar to MetaMask, and you can have this plugin. You go to Dapp and you sign your transaction with that plugin. But that's not enough. You also have a second key on your phone or on an app. So you will sign your transaction from the plugin, and you will get a push notification on your phone, and then you have to sign the transaction a second time to confirm it. So that's kind of a very simple thing you can do with this smart contract wallets, but then there are many more. So another thing is you effectively can pay gas costs with tokens. So roughly how that works is you have, let's say you have your Gnosis Safe, and you only have a DAI in that safe contract. You would need Ether to pay the gas costs, obviously. What we enable here is that you sign something called a meta transaction. So you're signing the transaction you actually want to do, but you're also signing that you are paying whoever submits this meta transaction to the Ethereum blockchain. You pay them a little bit of DAI. So for the user, effectively, our wallet will allow them to do transactions without having to have Ether.
So I know all the people that are interested in economic extraction just popped up. And I know you and I have had conversations in the past around this as well, and that could be a whole episode itself on Into the Ether. So we should do that at another date for sure. I mean, this wallet opens up all kinds of possibilities. And one of my favorite things is the funds recovery and some of the unique ways you can do around that. For instance, if I were to lose my keys to the wallet, Gnosis Safe has a lot of different ways for me to recover that. Could you walk through some of those?
Yeah, I have to say at this point, those are not implemented yet. I mean, we have still the seed phrase concept, and you can recover with that. However, we are working on those concepts around social recovery and even a step beyond. So the two things we are working on is within the setup process, you could define a group of people you could enable a rule that this group of people can, in a way, recover your safe, or basically that means change the keys that have access to that safe. And what you can basically do is you select five people you know or you trust, and define if four out of those five triggers this recovery process. And you probably also want to have like a time delay. So let's say 4 week delay, so they can trigger this recovery process. Then you have 4 weeks time. If they should, for whatever reason, be malicious, the people you trust, they still might be malicious, then you still have 4 weeks time to stop it if you actually haven't lost your keys. But if you have lost your keys, then after 4 weeks, you get new keys. We'll basically then have access to the safe.
That's really, really cool. I mean, I'm excited to check that feature out. I mean, I think one of the biggest intimidating factors for most people, maybe not yet in crypto, but interested, is the fact that they can lose their key or their seed phrase and then everything's gone. So if we can solve that problem, I think we're going to see a big inflow of new people. And, you know, this goes beyond just losing seed phrases too. Like the example you just gave, if you trusted four people and they could trigger this and recover funds, I mean, that could be used for maybe someone passes away as well, right? So it's in their will and now these people can recover those funds. So that's really, really cool stuff. And I know for Gnosis Safe, the Android app and the Chrome extension are out. What are the current plans for the iOS app?
Yeah, the iOS app is already submitted to the App Store and is currently in review by Apple. So depends on Apple, but should really come very soon.
That's great. That's a selfish question for me, by the way. So that's a great review of everything Gnosis is working on. And again, all these products sound great. So I guess in closing, this week I started something new on Twitter where I asked people to submit their most popular questions or their favorite questions for the guests. And then I would kind of walk through one or two of them. So and going on that theme, Mariano from Maker commented that you recently said some Gnosis employees were being paid in DAI. Are there any stats around that? He was curious.
Yeah, to be honest, I think currently one employee is paid in DAI. Well, we had a period where we had limited banking access and paid good number of employees in Ether. And that was at the period where Ether was in some cases dropping 10-15% a day. And that, of course, is not great. So during that period, we had the need for DAI payments. But once we gave employees the option to also receive dollars, I think the main factor for them was that it was still somewhat expensive to convert DAI to dollar or euros, because at least back then there were no DAI fiat markets. So answer is one employee.
Hey, one's better than zero. I'm sure this is going to become a common thing because it also takes the volatility out of, you know, being paid in some other crypto, and the markets are kind of popping up for DAI and there's better liquidity there. So, and the other question we got on Twitter was just how Gnosis and Augur differ, which we covered already. So I think we're good on that one. So what's the best place for people to kind of follow you and the work that Gnosis is doing?
Yeah, we are the two places where we are most active is Twitter and our blog. I would say on that note that we are always interested in learn how we can improve communications. I can say we are doing a bunch of things and we have sometimes a hard time communicating this properly. So if people have recommendations or requests, how, in what form we should communicate, we are definitely open to that.
Nice. Yeah. And hopefully this podcast helped get the word out there a little bit too on the current state of things. But yeah, definitely if people have feedback, I would supply it to Martin. And I know you guys are very responsive, at least on Twitter from my past experience. So that's great. Well, thanks for joining me today, Martin. I think it's been a great discussion.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can subscribe to us at podcast.ethub.io, as well as follow us on Twitter at econoar and @zazzle0x.